at 8 p.m., which is 9 o'clock Eastern time, when the president comes on, we're going to have it on the large screen here. So you're welcome to stay, or if you feel you need to go home, whichever pleases you. But we do have it arranged so that you can see the and hear the speech here. And if you're so inclined, we have this room until we leave. If you want to have dialogue after that, we can do that as well. Good evening. My name is Barbara Nichols, and I'm the chapter president of UNA Dane County Chapter, which is an affiliate of the United Nations Association of America. And we are one of over 119 chapters throughout the United States. The Dane County Chapter is very proud of the fact that it has been in existence for 65 years. So we have a long history of being an advocate for social justice and human rights issues. A few announcements and procedural points before we begin. I would like to bring to your attention that on October 24th, from 5:30 to 7:30 at the University Club, we will be celebrating United Nations Day. United Nations Day acknowledges the creation of the United Nations 68 years ago, and we will be hosting a reception. It costs $20 to attend, $10 for students, and there's information as you have entered the hall that would give you more information. You can register online, or you can purchase tickets from individual members. My second announcement is that the chapter hosts what's known as a Trivia League, and a Trivia League presents information, trends, and issues internationally. It's directed and oriented towards young people, and these league games are played in over 55 pubs in Dane County, and over 3,000 people play weekly. What does it mean if you play in our league? It means this: you become more knowledgeable about international issues and trends, and at the end of the season, which goes September through December, there is a championship game, and the winner of the championship game receives $500. Our summer season ended August 3rd, and because the Trivia League is oriented towards young folks, the winner was sexual veiled preference was the winner of the championship game. Actually, they're very astute individuals. Most of them work, I can't think of the name of the company in Middleton. Most of them work at Epic, so they were really difficult. The questions were tough, and they were really very good. But the names, I think they, you know, young folks, they try to outdo each other with the names, which make us more seasoned folks a little nervous. Like putting that up on our website, but that is their name. I would like to welcome you then to our lecture series. The programs that the UNA Dane County presents are the following. We have a lecture series that focuses on topical issues that the United Nations is involved in, and it runs September through June, and it occurs the second Tuesday of the month here at Predlin Hall, and we find speakers with expertise on particular topics, and I'll be introducing our topic this evening. Our second area of programming is the trivia sponsorship of the Trivia League. And thirdly, this year we are starting a gathering where it's called A Taste of the World, in which we will be dining in international restaurants and describing issues, trends, and the culture of that particular country based on the restaurant that we are eating. And finally, we participate with other groups in Dane County and the Madison area that relate to human rights, social justice, and peace issues. So we hope that you will continue to be of interest and join us in our activities for this chapter. Tonight, I'm pleased to announce that we are kicking off our series with a very pertinent and significant topic: precedents for addressing criminal international activities, the case of Syria. And our presenter will be Professor Elder. All I can say, what a difference a day makes. I'm not sure what the focus would have been maybe even 2 hours ago, but I'm sure it'll be an interesting conversation and dialogue. Professor Elder teaches at the university, and I'm sorry I don't have his bio, and I'm not giving him his proper due, so I will ask him to introduce himself because he has a long history of community activity and is a very wise expert in the areas of the Middle East. After his presentation, there will be an opportunity for dialogue and conversation, and at 8 o'clock, we will stream live to hear the president's speech, and we would invite you, when that's over, to continue the dialogue and discussion. So on that note, I'd ask Professor Elder to come, and please don't be bashful. Please give us your background, since I did not give you justice. I should say that the program tonight is being taped for radio WIDELP.
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you, everybody who's here this evening, because you could be sitting at home waiting for the president to talk an hour from now. I'm kind of glad that he waited to hear from me, because he may be wanting to scribble some additions to what he's going to say, because you just never can tell. When I agreed to plan something for tonight, this was clear that Syria was in a crisis. It looked very much like we might be on the brink of launching something which would make the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan look almost like a caper. If we had proceeded as we had with a military attack, we could have been in something which would have been absolutely horrendous. It was hard to picture any way in which any kind of precise, limited thing would not have exploded into something which would have been engulfed at least Syria and many other countries. Now I'm glad I didn't prepare my notes last Friday. I keep telling my students, plan ahead, get things done. So it wasn't until, I did the background work for the first page, and then when things began to happen, I sort of added the map in the second page, because a lot has happened just in the last 48 hours. And I must say, I'm cheered by what happens. I realize there are lots of bumps in the road still. But when we were looking at what could well have been a president who said, I don't care what Congress says, my honor is on the line. I said if a red line was crossed, there would be a penalty to pay for it, and I will make somebody pay the penalty. And you listen to that and realize the power that the president has as the chief executive of the military. He could do that technically within his rights. The very fact that he decided to turn to Congress led me lead a little bit of a sigh of relief. The fact that Congress appeared so reluctant gave me some cheer, but I think what's happened in the last 48 hours is really kind of exciting, and sort of what I was going to recommend, but he didn't call me. Okay, when I was preparing this, I was advised to try to keep the UN in my account, and there's no way the UN could be kept out of the account, because when one gets into the issue of addressing international criminal activities, or what are international activities, the UN is absolutely dead center. And if anybody in this room feels the UN is underrepresented and understudied, you just have to look at what's really going on. I think often the UN gets a pretty weak press in the United States, and actually on the UW campus. I've looked for courses on the UN, and typically they are tangential. The notion is it's American power, it's sort of military apparatus, it's international relations and all the rest. And the UN tends to be overlooked until something like a crisis happens, and here we are. Okay, where does the idea of the state come from? Go back to the Holy Roman Empire. It was started in northwest German province of Saxony around the 10th century. And up until then, there was no real notion of what a nation was, or the way in which an area could be controlled under some kind of central authority. The idea of the Holy Roman Empire spread south, finally included most of Central Europe, Germany, Switzerland, Italy, Spain's sort of supported off to the western side. And the idea was that the Pope was the spiritual ruler of Christendom, and the Emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, was to be the secular ruler. They disagreed a lot, the question of where the temporal and the spiritual overlap was contested over the decades. But still there was an idea of an empire and a group of people under some kind of authority. The countries that were outside the Holy Roman Empire resisted the idea of there being a central entity. On the east side included Poland, Hungary, and Serbia, the north, Denmark, and the Scandinavian countries, and the west, France, and England. So even when the Holy Roman Empire was there for centuries, there were these disagreeing sections that felt the Holy Roman Empire was not quite entitled to everything that it felt was relevant. And then came Martin Luther. I'm sure Martin Luther, when he nailed his 95 theses on the Wittenberg Castle, assumed he was just going to get into a debate on theology and the role of the church. I think he had no idea that he was going to start a process of violent wars over the central part of Europe for a century and a half. Because once you began to identify where the Catholics were and where the Protestants were, and then which prince was Catholic and which prince was Protestant, and if the Protestant prince was torturing Catholics, did the Catholic prince have the right to invade the Protestant country? It was total chaos. And the notion that you had to avenge your group and cross whatever border was possible. So for about a century and a half, we had one of the bloodiest periods in European history until we got to the 20th century, and we did much better. But in 1648, there finally was the Peace of Westphalia. It looks like something you'd have to learn only for a history course. But probably the most relevant thing that emerged from the Peace of Westphalia was the idea of a nation and what a nation was entitled to do and what a nation could do. And interestingly enough, the notion of the state, the sovereign state, continues right up to the present. And when the UN was founded, one of its principles was the sovereign state. The states that joined the UN joined with the understanding that no other state could legally invade them, but they also carry the obligation of not invading any other state. And that principle has more or less continued with fudging here and there and violations indeed over the intervening centuries. The principle was that what happens within one nation is that nation's business. You must respect each other's embassies and their diplomats, and that continues up to the present. One reason that what happened in Tehran after the Ayatollah Khomeini took over was so shocking was because the Iranian public violated that notion that our embassy staff are protected. They are American territory. And if you put them into prison, you have violated a very fundamental right. And if you were to do that to everybody's embassy officials, there'd be total chaos. There must be the notion that these people are sovereignly protected. They are American property or Yugoslav property or Indian property, and you don't touch them because they are, in a sense, sovereign. This lasted up to the present. There were two major exceptions, and these were two men who thought they could create a super state. One was Napoleon Bonaparte. He died in 1821 on an island, and Adolf Hitler, who died in Berlin as the war ended in 1945. But the notion that there could be a super state, and that maybe that's the way to organize the world, emerged in these two very powerful forms. In the meantime, during most of the centuries, there was a notion of, okay, sovereign states are entitled to not be invaded. They have an obligation not to invade others. And there are ways in which, as sovereign entities, they can work with each other. So in the 1800s and 1900s, there's an emergence, actually a staggering emergence of international organizations. The first major known was the International Committee for the Red Cross in 1861. But very quickly, you had the International Telecommunications Union, international agreements on maritime regulations, international regulations on waiting, stamps, all sorts of things. As countries said, okay, we will retain our sovereignty, but we will work with other people to come up with combinations of things so we can deal with the world nations as they are. Then came World War I, and one of the interesting features about World War I was it was triggered by binational treaties. When it goes back to the assassination of the Archduke, it was a trivial event. But once you had the trivial event being avenged by the person who was harmed by the Archduke's death, who was then allied by their people who said they would protect them, who were then challenged by the people who disagreed with them, in something like 2 months, Europe exploded. And where prior to that, there had been the notion Europe can't have a war. It's too integrated. People are crossing lines. People are going to school, various places. The musicians and artists are traveling back and forth. And because of these bilateral commitments, that if you are attacked, I will defend you, and if you are attacked, I will defend you, we went into one of the silliest, well, it's hard to say which is the silliest war. They compete severely, but a very silly war with a lot of people killed. And in the war, among other things, there was a lot of use of poison gas. At the end of World War I, there was a notion that maybe we should have some kind of an international organization, respecting the sovereignty of each nation. We're not creating a super nation, but we'll have some way in which there can be some overarching executive or judiciary or legislative arrangement. Woodrow Wilson, the college president, who then became the U.S. president, actually sort of dreamt up the idea of the League of Nations and then tried very hard to convince the United States to join the League, and he failed. But the idea of the League picked up in Europe, and so there was a League of Nations. Its goal sounded noble: to disarm nations, now that World War I was over, to maintain the peace. And they did a lot of work. They tried to get nations to identify where their weapons were, to reduce their weapons, with the notion that if you don't have large arsenals, you're much less likely to go to war. But the lack of ability to enforce what they said began to become vital. Finally, when Italy decided that it was going to go into Abyssinia, and the League of Nations said, you can't, and Italy said, there's no way you can stop me, it became clear the League was a paper tiger. And very quickly, Germany withdrew, Italy withdrew, Japan withdrew, and the scene was opened up for the emergence of World War II. Before World War II, however, there was the Geneva Protocol on Biochemical Weapons, and that was an international agreement that these weapons, this mustard gas and the other gases that were used, were really awful. It's hard enough to have wars going on, but the way in which you die if you inhale these gases, nerve gas and mustard gas, are just so horrible. Nobody wins. And the danger with these things, they're so sloppy that once they're in the air, you could be killing your own troops as well as the other troops. So it was a messy weapon, ugly, produced people who were crippled for the rest of their lives with breathing problems. So the notion was, let's just say this is off the table. We aren't going to have any kind of poison gases in the future. Then came World War II. The Holocaust was happening, but the grimness and the extent of it wasn't clear until World War II ended. And I mean, the theme of never again, I think, began to emerge. The world community should be able to do something so that something like this never happens again. 6 million people, give or take, put to death while in one of the presumably most civilized sections of the world. So there were various efforts set up to see that would not happen again. Among other things, there was an effort to identify who were responsible for the war, the Germans and the Japanese. The Nuremberg trials were established. From a lawyer's point of view, these are cooked up. There was no systematic basis for bringing charges against the Nazis or against the Japanese. There were no sort of rules of war that they had violated. So the Nuremberg trial, they came up with something that they could say, you did something so awful that we are going to punish you. But in any system of law, presumably you have laws, and then you have the ways in which they are identified and people are tested, and they're found guilty or not guilty and punished or not. And it was very sloppy. Finally, in the end, there were 9 Germans who were hanged and 1 Japanese who was executed. And in the process, 2 principles emerged which still continue to sort of haunt the notion of these war crimes trials. One is that the excuse my superiors told me doesn't get you off the hook necessarily. The standard was, I did what I was told to do, and all of us had to do that. But that doesn't necessarily clear you of responsibility. And the other was the other end of it. This was what the Japanese general Yamamoto said. He said, I didn't know my troops were doing these things. And he was told, you as a general were responsible, even if you didn't know what they were doing. And then he was also executed. But when you looked at those 9 executed Germans and 1 executed Japanese, it was just sort of a polite form of the winners kill the losers. and the notion that there was any real body of law established, what technically could you say they had broken or violated in order to put them to death? But it did raise the question of is it possible to come up with something that would say, these are laws which if you break, and these are the way you identify the laws, these are what you will be punished for. So the United Nations was founded, and the principle of non-interference of nations was built into it. You joined the UN with the understanding that you gave up none of your sovereignty. One could look back and say sometimes, well, things, in fact, we're going to get to R2P and some other suggestions later on, but every nation that joined the United Nations, and they joined fairly quickly, was assured, your integrity remains, you are a sovereign nation, the UN will never walk into your territory, and no other country will. You come in as a sovereign nation. And that was the basis for the countries going in and joining them. We have the Five Nations Security Council with a veto, and then all the other countries, the General Assembly, and there's nobody in this room I need to tell that to because that's so basic. We can complain about the Security Council. We've had several meetings saying, could the UN be improved? But it has managed to work even in this sort of cumbersome fashion of the five winning nations being the Security Council having the veto and all the other nations having a general statement in the General Assembly. So the four goals of the UN, and I abridge them from the text, save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. That was sort of the same thing as the League of Nations. Let's not go to war. It must be some way we can prevent wars from happening. And the power of that save succeeding generations from the scourge of war remains there. If anybody wants to beat up on the UN, they can say the UN has failed because there have been wars and wars and wars and wars and wars since 1945. But if one can look at the ways in which wars were prevented and in which after wars pieces were put back together, the UN has played a crucial part. Second, respect for international law. And this is a challenge because there wasn't much you could call international law. You had sort of commercial laws so that if you were shipping in China or you were buying lumber in Indonesia, there were certain things you had to follow. But there wasn't a clear set of these are international laws, these are norms that you must follow. And you violate them, you will stand trial somewhere. And you'll have the right to be heard and the right to appeal. And if you're found guilty, you will be punished by somebody. Third, reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights. I skipped that. That is almost the most important. The coming together of the Declaration of Human Rights was a huge creation of the United Nations. And that has become a reference point for a whole lot of things since then. What is it that each individual in the world is entitled to just because that person is an individual? That was an idea that was not grounded in anything but sort of dream and mythology. But when the International Declaration of Human Rights came out, the fact that every country signed on with some slight waivers, that was a huge conceptual achievement by the world community, that every individual, regardless of what nation they belong to, or their race or gender or anything, is entitled as a human being to these rights. There were debates between the West and the communist countries, and the colonies, when they came in, they had different notions of what were the important rights. But the way in which it finally emerged is quite striking that these different opinions came together with the International Declaration. So then we have the statement of fundamental rights, respect for international law, and finally promote better standards of life. And here we get into the Millennium Development Goals and a whole series of things that the UN has been working on in order to make life better for many people in the world. What did the Charter say about waging war? Well, Chapter 5, Article 51, and I quote directly from it, and again, the notion of the sovereign nation, that you have the right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the United Nations. So the right of the sovereign state is if you're attacked, you are entitled to defend yourself. And it goes on in subsequent clauses to say how you can line up other nations to be beside you. And ultimately, you're okay. The war you're waging is one that is seen as justifiable according to the way in which things have been set up. When one looks at the way in which this has been referred to and looks at, for example, could the U.S. use this to get into the war in Afghanistan? You realize how stretched the notion can be of armed attack. What happened in 9/11 was interpreted through a series of kind of fanciful conjectures to say, since Afghanistan had been the base for training the people who had the ideas which led to the people from Saudi Arabia being in the planes to attack Manhattan, we could bomb Afghanistan. And that is a stretch no matter how you look at it. But it was used as some kind of a basis for saying, no, the U.S. was attacked and therefore the U.S. has a right to go into Afghanistan. And we're still there. We haven't quite managed to get out from that one. 1945, we also, 46, saw the establishment of the International Court of Justice. This was an effort, and it goes back also to the League of Nations, is it couldn't be a place where nations who disagree could meet and argue. And under the League of Nations, there was a world court. This was where countries came. And the idea was, why don't you present your case to lawyers or judges and historians and settle in that way instead of, you know, fighting, using submarines, bombing, and so on, to say, here's where the line's supposed to be, or here's where the other line's supposed to be. So there was some hope that the International Court of Justice would make it possible for nations who were perhaps thinking of going to war to say, that's silly, it's expensive, why don't we make the best case we can to a group of judges and lawyers and historians and see what the record actually shows. But that was not dealing with individual criminals. This was a case where only nation states were debating with each other. 1948, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and I just tuck in political, economic, and post-colonial rights. And as you read the sections of the International Declaration, you can see here's where the West came in, here's where the Soviet bloc came in, and here's where the colonies came in. The thumbprint of these different parts of the world is quite clear as you go through the declaration. 1949, we're now on flip page 2. Another advantage of this is you sort of see how close I am to the end. So you can sort of see there is an end in sight. Fourth Geneva Convention. After World War I, there was this great concern. If we fight, let's draw certain boundaries to say this is totally unacceptable. We aren't going to be savages. We're not going to eat the bodies of other people we kill. There's certain things we will do just as civilized people. So we're busy killing each other and trying to win. But there are boundaries that we feel we will say collectively, you can't cross that without some kind of punishment. So there were a series of conventions, 1864, 1906, 1929. 1949 was the most recent one. There have been several provisos added to that, but essentially this deals with the wartime rights. What can you do when there's a war on, and what can you not do when there's a war on? So it defined the rights of prisoners, the protection of the wounded, the protection of civilians around war zones. This almost becomes a joke when you look at it. But presumably when there's a war on, both warring parties have a responsibility to see the civilians are as protected as possible from the protagonist. The very nature of war today is such that in any major conflict, there are far more civilians killed. So even though the Geneva Convention says they are to be protected, the nature of the way in which wars are fought leaves them quite unprotected. The Geneva Convention identified what's called grave breaches, and these were things which were seen as so horrendous that the world community could say that is unacceptable. Again, the question of enforcement, of evidence, and so on is there, but the notion that we collectively shudder at certain things that should be done, even when wars are being carried out. The convention obliged the signatories to help prosecute violators, and ultimately it was up to the UN Security Council to implement this, knowing again the Security Council has no weapons. There is no UN army. And so once again, as with the League of Nations, the question of how do you enforce this becomes a little bit thin in the way in which the world is structured. So we jump forward almost a half a century to 1993. We've been through the series of wars in West Asia. We've been through the Vietnam War. And now the UN-initiated Chemical Weapons Convention. This became effective in 1997. Each of these bills, the date is tricky because it'll be introduced, and it'll be debated, and then it'll be accepted, and then they'll be signed, and then every nation has to take it back to their own country and get it ratified. And then when you get a certain number of countries ratifying, it comes into effect. So typically there's sort of a 4 or 5 year period where it's being signed on to, and then bingo, you get the right number, and then it's in effect. And then the countries that have signed onto it say, okay, we are following it, and those who haven't can say, we have not followed it. But it can become a convention. And the Chemical Weapons Convention prohibited the production of chemical weapons, and I put it in, not biological. We were still thinking of mustard gas. We weren't thinking of the kind of things that have since become complicated, and what one does about biological weapons is going to remain tricky for a while. Called for no production, the destruction of whatever was out there, and the destruction of the facilities. Now, for many people, this seemed like an archaic question, because this was the weapon of World War I. We've been through World War II. Virtually nobody used, there's a little bit of use of poison gas in World War II, but it was totally ineffective in terms of a successful weapon of any sort of serious sort. So it was coming late, but it was going back to say that we don't want to have chemical weapons. They established the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. This would be the sort of watchdog. Again, it doesn't have an army, but it's a group of people whose job it is to keep up on the news. It's interesting to see which UN members did not sign: Angola, North Korea, Egypt, Southern Sudan, and Syria. So Syria begins to stand out a little bit, but not completely unique. There's Egypt, there's North Korea, and other countries that just said, we are not going to sign on this. We have the right, we feel, to continue producing and maintaining chemical weapons. There were several UN members that signed but did not ratify. So you sign, take it back to your country, and your country says, we're not going to sign it. And interestingly enough, Israel signed and then didn't ratify it. And once it's not ratified, I mean, Israel is not part of that either. And then Myanmar also signed the document, but it went back to the authorities. They did not ratify it. So one could say neither Israel nor Syria at the moment is bound by the provisions of this chemical weapon convention. Now we come to something which I think begins to get quite interesting in terms of where we are at this moment with Syria. What do you do when there's something, when the Holocaust is relived? The notion that somewhere you're watching the destruction of civilians and nobody is doing anything about it. And in a sense, you aren't supposed to invade the country because it's a sovereign country. And if you do invade the country, you're violating the treaty. You're not supposed to invade the country. So you're stuck. And as you watch these horrible things happen, in Rwanda and Yugoslavia were the two places where really terrible things were happening, in the sense somebody has to do something. But if you were to do it, you'd be attacking a sovereign state, and that was a violation of the UN Charter. So in 1993, in response to what happened in Yugoslavia, the Security Council passed Resolution 827, and watch what they called it, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. It's very ad hoc. It said, let us set up a tribunal, and let us look at what happened in Yugoslavia, and let us identify those who are responsible for what actually went on. Perhaps the most horrendous thing that was remembered was the Srebrenica massacre, in which there were 8,000 or more Muslim men who were in prison, and they were killed by Christian Serbs. And it was kept secret for a long time. The bodies were buried in various places. And then the awful truth came out that this entire prison, several prisons, where every single one was massacred, and the echoes of the Holocaust comes back, you can't just stand by and allow that thing to happen. So the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, it's just for that country, was set up. It's worked relatively well. The detention, it has indicted 10 individuals, including former presidents and prime ministers. It's quite a list of people who were having parties with each other, sort of clicking champagne glasses with each other, who are now in cells, some of them for the rest of their life in The Hague. It's a comfortable cell. I've seen a picture of it. And they get to play checkers and watch movies, but they are in prison in several cases for the rest of their lives. Their prison is near the Hague. The next year, a similar resolution was passed, and again, it was a Security Council, which means the five nations. This is US, China, Russia, Britain, and France. Resolution 955 established the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and the deaths there were horrendous, not quite the Jews in the Holocaust, but 800,000 Tutus killed by Hutus. The tribunal was set up so that it worked from Arusha in Tanzania. 17 neighboring countries agreed to provide prison facilities, and this means that they bear the cost of the prisoners until the prisoners die or until they are released. In The Hague, it's taken care of through the process of The Hague. So a fair number of African countries agreed that this process should continue, and they're willing to say our prisons are available. Presently, one individual has been found guilty, five are in custody, three are being tried, one has been acquitted, and nine are fugitives. One thing this does, and did after the Yugoslav thing, was once you're indicted, even if you're not in prison, you are a prisoner in your country usually, and if you cross a border and a passport, you're likely to be nabbed. And several of the Yugoslav leaders thought, time has passed, no one's going to catch me. And one of them went into Germany, bingo, the bell went off, and they were in handcuffs and in The Hague, and they're now awaiting trial. So you become ostracized in terms of the civilized world as an individual held accountable for what you did. 1998, the UN General Assembly approved the statute establishing the International Criminal Court to try individuals. Now this, it was a major step. Up until now, it was the International Criminal Court, and it was the International Court of Justice. It was countries charging each other. And I think perhaps on the basis of Yugoslavia and Rwanda, the notion ultimately people have to be held accountable, and often the leaders have to be held accountable. If you attack a nation, often the leaders are left scot-free. It's the guys in the barracks, the guys in the front lines who get killed, and the leaders end up going someplace where they're perhaps protected diplomatically. So the idea was we must set up a court in which individuals are tried. And the basis for the trial was genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and crimes of aggression. And now you begin to get the spelling out of what is genocide. How do you say this is genocide? And then if this person can be found to have ordered something which is genocide or participated in something which one sees as genocide, they can be tried for it. Crimes against humanity, these are spelled out again. So you begin to get the basis of evidential law. If you do this, you're likely to be found guilty of. Very different from the Nuremberg trials or the Japanese trials after World War II. Three states that originally signed the statute informed the UN Secretary General that they would not participate in the international criminal courts. And here we are, US, Israel, and Sudan. Again, at the original meeting, the US signed on, came back, and the US decided that they were going to withdraw their signature. So we are not a signatory of the International Criminal Court. That may be embarrassing, and it's also patently clear why we don't. There's an awareness that people like a number of people, Vietnam War people, could probably or possibly be held responsible. Napalm, who issued that, who ordered that. The use of Agent Orange, these all begin to get into arenas where people could be held as criminals, and then there are people who could be identified in the Foreign Service, in the military, who could conceivably be taken on trial. And the U.S. is very, very reluctant to allow somebody like Henry Kissinger to be taken over to The Hague and ask a series of questions. So we just say we aren't going to play by that. But there's a certain loss of, I think, respect for the United States by the United States saying, you can't even charge us with being criminals because we are not going to allow you to imprison or try Americans who might be in violation of these things. 41 other nations, including China and India, have not signed the statute, but it has enough people passed, so it is the law of the world, except if you haven't signed it, you're not obliged, or if you have withdrawn from it, you are not obliged to. Okay, we come to this millennium, post-2000. The International Criminal Court has opened investigations into events in, and here we run through a series of places where rather sordid things have happened. Sierra Leone, Cambodia, Lebanon, especially the assassination of Ratik Harari, and Kosovo. And there are various ways cases can be brought to the court, and the fact that this is now alive and open is itself an interesting process. Now we come to a slightly different point, and people in this room can feel at mixed feelings about this. 2006 is Security Resolution 1674. Again, Security Council, this is the five big nations, agreed, supported the responsibility of national governments to protect their own populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity, or nicknamed R2P. Now, on one hand, that sounds good. Nations should not do cruel things to their own citizens. And this is a statement of policy. And it was an effort to say Rwanda should not be allowing people to be killed. Yugoslavia should not be allowing people to be killed. Nobody should allow people, their own citizens, to be killed. But this begins to get a little waffly because at what point, what do you do if there is a nation that is harming its own citizens? And you begin to get into that sort of slippery slope of the Westphalia Treaty. If I'm a Protestant and I don't like the fact that they're pulling the fingernails off Protestants in my neighboring country, I'm going to attack that neighboring country. Or if they don't like the fact that I'm pulling fingernails off Catholics, they're going to come here. The minute you agree with that kind of thing, I can go in because I don't like what they're doing to my friends, then the whole system begins to break down. So it's a touchy issue, and it's something that's going to be with us for a while, but it has a label. It is a Security Council resolution, and it did come into play, sure enough, in 2011. Security Council Resolution 1973 supported the Libyan no-fly zone and the use of all means necessary to protect civilians in Libya. I expected the U.S. to bring out the R2P bigger in Libya, because when Colonel Gaddafi was suggesting attacking people in Benghazi and treating them as though they were rats, this was scary. But very quickly it slipped into we're protecting civilians to we are killing anybody who appears to be supporting the ruler, the dictatorship in Libya. And one would have to say, in fairness, that no-fly zone very quickly became a military zone, and it led to the fall of Gaddafi and ultimately his death. So whether the goal was to protect civilians, there were lots of civilians who were killed by the way in which the no-fly zone of the protector was carried out, and it looks much messier than one would have liked to have. And then finally, the note, the UN has generally condemned a sovereign state that engages in an armed attack against another sovereign nation, even if the outcome might be interpreted as beneficial. And I put two such cases. I'm a Quaker. I hate wars. I try to do everything I can to prevent them from happening. But sometimes when a war is over, you sort of have to say, well, something was kind of achieved. And the two that could be picked out, one was the Bangladesh War. India went into Pakistan, into East Pakistan, after the West Pakistan Army was tearing up East Pakistan. It began in March and it went into December, and 10 million people fled from East Pakistan into India. And India finally got tired and sent its army in about 2 weeks, defeated the Pakistan Army, imprisoned all the Pakistani soldiers, and within 6 weeks it left. So it contributed to the freedom of what became Bangladesh in an effort to say that what was going on was impossible for India because of 10 million refugees and also was impossible in terms of human rights. Nonetheless, India was condemned by the UN because it attacked a sovereign nation. Similarly, with the Vietnam going into Pol Pot's Cambodia. Again, what was happening in Cambodia with Pol Pot was appalling. The Vietnamese government went in. It was roundly denounced by the U.S. and the U.N., but in the end, there eventually was the elimination of Pol Pot, and Cambodia began to have elections, so one can say the outcome ultimately could be beneficial, but it was condemned because of what it had done. Then, sort of to wrap up, and this is before 2 days ago, the U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has stated that if the U.S. has an armed attack against Syria, it would violate the U.N. Charter. I was struck that in the various debates, our president rarely mentioned that this was clearly a violation of the UN Charter. Various other sorts of explanations made for it, but it was announced by Ban Ki-moon, and virtually any international lawyer would say it would be a crime. It would be an international crime. Okay, let's move to the map and a little bit about history. This is a map from a week or so ago in The Economist, and a feature about every country in that part of the world is how complicated it is. I teach a course called Social Structure of Muslim Societies, and every time you go into another society, well, now it looks like a country. Wait, let me say, on the east there's this, and the south there's this, and the west there's this. And you can't understand the country until you sort of know the component parts. Here, religion is important. About 60% of the Syrians are Sunnis, and most of the Muslims in the world are Sunnis. The Shias, and these are those who split away from the Sunnis, about 680 in the Common Era, and have a whole series of imams, which are the Shiite imams. They all accept the principles of the Quran, and they all accept the five pillars. So to that, they're all Muslims. But then the notion of which tradition of interpretation of the Quran do you follow, and the Sunnis follow one line, and the Shiites follow another line, and the Shiites follow a line of inheritance from the Prophet Ali, and then his son Hassan and Hussein, and then a series of subsequent children, often until you get to the 12th imam. And then among the followers of the imam, some who say the 7th imam was particularly important, and some who say the 10th imam. So it's no more complicated than having Protestants and Episcopalians and Catholics and Benedictines and all the rest. It's impossible for people outside the Christian world to understand how the Christian world lasts, but it's very complicated similarly. So the Shiites, about 13%, and Assad is a Shiite. In fact, he's an Alawite, and that is one of the subsects of the Shiites. And they get into the final section. There are 12 imams, and then the last imam disappeared and is going to come back at the end of the world, as Jesus will come with the Messiah, and he'll be the Mahdi, and the world will come to be good. So they are looking for the return of the imam. And until then, there are a series of ayatollahs who stand in for the imam until the imam comes. So it's a subset of a subset, but looking for, and a mystical element, the coming of the final imam. Christians, 10%, a little bit fewer than you have Shiites. Druze, that's a unique hill version of Islam, which doesn't exist anywhere else in the world, in an other. So it's widely scattered, and when you look at the population, the map, although it's of where territory is controlled, sort of tells you where the Alawites are and where the rest are. The darker area on the left is primarily where Assad's friends are. They are the on the left side, they are on the coast of the Mediterranean and go up north. The Sunnis are all over the place, and especially down the Euphrates River Valley. That area in the middle is pretty bleak. It's kind of a desert. So you have people living near the coast, mostly concentrated of Alawites and Shiites, and then the Sunnis elsewhere, and crowded around the Euphrates River. And in the upper left-hand corner, it doesn't say there are the Kurds, and the Kurds have their own nationality and language. And as some of you know, I'm a Kurd. I was born in Kurdish territory in Iran. So at least three, four, five different groups, and they in some ways come together, in some ways they don't. Quickly running through what's happened. For a long time, Damascus has been an important capital. For a couple of centuries, the Umayyad Caliphate, which is one of the most important Islamic empires. 1516, it became part of the Ottoman Empire, which essentially had its capital in Istanbul. Lasted for four centuries. Ottoman Empire lost World War II to the Allied powers in 1920. The Allied powers placed Syria under the French. They divided up the Ottoman Empire. This is French, this is English, and they'll, in a sense, work them toward becoming independent. 1930, the Syrian Republic was established, and 6 years later, they had their first president. So there is a history of democratic elections and party politics in Syria. But Syria didn't become actually independent until after World War II, became independent from France, and it joined the UN, and from that point on, it's been an active member of the UN. 1948, when Israel came into existence, Syria participated in the war against Israel and has been constantly hostile to Israel and vice versa. 1958 to 61, Syria tried something interesting. There's been a notion often in the Arab world that why don't we just have an Arab nation? We have so much in common. We're all Muslim. These large sections of the world speak Arabic. Let's have, instead of Syria and Jordan and Lebanon and Egypt and Morocco and all that, let's just have an Arab nation. And so they tried it. And like a trial marriage, it didn't work very well. It lasted for only a few years, and then they went back to becoming separate countries. 1967 was a war in which Israel took a fair amount of territory, and the territory that Syria felt worst about was the Golan Heights, and Syria maintains the Golan Heights is Syrian, and Israel maintains it's not going to ever be Syrian again. Now we begin to get into the family. 1970, Hafez al-Assad, head of the Syrian government. There were protests. He's a minority group. The majority were not happy with that. There were protesters, and they were put down very, very harshly. 1976 to 2005, Syria moved into Lebanon and had a major presence there, and there was at least one or two wars that went on at that time, and eventually left with a great deal of public pressure saying, Syria, it's time to get out of Lebanon. 2000, Hafez al-Assad died. His son Bashar al-Assad was elected president. It was a bloodless coup. In 2007, Israel bombed a suspected nuclear reactor in Syria. Again, the notion that there's a tension between Syria and Israel has gone on for a long time. And now we come to the recent past. 2011, following the Arab Spring, anti-Assad protests and government retaliation became increasingly violent. At first, it looked a lot like the Spring Revolution. Nonviolent, Egypt had toppled, Tunisia had toppled. It looked like this might topple, but then all of a sudden it became clear that Assad was digging in his heels, had a strong army, controlled the air entirely. This was not going to be an easy pushover. And as the protests increased, the retaliation increased, and things became worse and worse. Army defectors formed the Syrian Free Army. So he began to have a political entity emerging with an army, but not any central command. Next year, 2012, the Syrian National Coalition was recognized. This was an effort to put together something to look like a government, saying, so here's the alternative. And it was recognized by the US, UK, and France, but it's been a feeble structure with a lot of differences of opinion. It's a symbol, and we say that is Syria, Assad is not Syria, but for most of the world, Assad is still the representative. Some Shiite countries, Iran, Hezbollah, and Lebanon, and Russia supported Assad, saying, look, he's the ruler, this is a civil war. Every ruler is entitled to put down civil people who want to separate. Some Sunni countries, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, supported the Free Syrian Army, and the volunteers joined the Free Syrian Army, some of them with links to Al-Qaeda and anti-US ideologies, and that has made this complicated. But this group isn't just, you know, our staunch friends who are looking for democracy, but there are groups in there that are fairly fierce and fairly Sunni and fairly eager to be violent. And to some extent, when one points out that if aid is given to them, they're giving them to the people who we've been trying to destroy in Iraq and Afghanistan, the world gets very complicated indeed. And now this year, 2013, estimated over 100,000 deaths in Syria, estimated 4 million Syrians who were displaced or sought refuge in Jordan, Iraq, Lebanon, and Turkey, placing overwhelming humanitarian burdens on the host country, with the bulk of support coming through the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. And once again, throughout this all, the importance of the UN cannot be underestimated because it's been there again and again. And what would be happening to these 4 million people is appalling if it weren't for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. I've seen the work they do, I saw it in Afghanistan, and they're a very impressive outfit. August 21, reported chemical attack in Damascus suburb that killed over 1,000, generated a rapid escalation of worldwide tensions, with President Obama threatening to launch military attack against Syria for crossing the red line. UN sent in a team of experts to bring back details of reported attack. September 9, before a subcommission of UN findings, Russia proposed Syrian chemical arsenal be placed under international control. September 10th, that's today, Syria agreed to Russia's proposal. The Senate postponed its vote on the proposed U.S. military attack against Syria. And that's sort of where we are now. And we have 5 minutes for questions and answer. Are there some questions and answers? Yes.
Thanks, Joe, for a wonderful lecture. I'm wondering, this is a kind of long-standing question or a debate I have with people about the effectiveness of the United Nations. It's such a good idea to have a Security Council with everybody participating in a cooperative way. Why doesn't the United States put wraparound pressure on countries like China and Russia, influence economically or in other ways, to get them to really participate in a cooperative way in the Security Council?
Okay, the question was, why doesn't the U.S. do more to get Russia and China to cooperate more in the Security Council. Yeah, okay. Probably because on certain basic points, we disagree with them and they disagree with us. They see us as ultimately looking for expanding our capitalist system and getting the world involved in ways in which the West can make profit. And so whenever we say, here's a treaty that we think is good, the first thing they're going to look is, who is making money off of this? And how are you trying to slip something over on us? It's not that they are all saints, but there is this notion that the U.S. and the West have centuries of exploitation and imperialism. And often what we're there for people's democracy. We're there to help them get educated. But when you look at the dust settles, where is the money going and who's making a profit? So there's a profound suspicion in both India and China, in both Russia and China, that the imperialist interests are overwhelming. And one could even sort of see that if they're looking at President Obama thinking of having a military attack at this particular point, it sort of makes no sense because it wouldn't stop the chemical weapons being used. It'd be perfectly easy for Assad to wave his ears and use a chemical attack the next day. Say, now what are you going to do? It was appeared to be sort of carelessly opening a position where the world could have been embroiled very quickly. And so I think the notion probably is that if military involvement is involved, the plan in Iraq was to make money and get oil. The plan in Afghanistan was to get access to their minerals. These plans, that's ultimately why the U.S. is there. And so if the U.S. is trying to sort of get into Syria, there must be some financial interest in it, or they wouldn't be doing something as risky as threatening to attack with weapons. So the different perspectives, and there are probably people in China and Russia saying, why can't we get the U.S. to behave better than we are? I think it's amazing to me that the Security Council has lasted as long as it had. And for three decades, it couldn't do anything, the Cold War. And it was only after the collapse of the Soviet Union that you've had a series of, I think, positive things. The very fact that these are Security Council resolutions indicate that cumbersome though it may be and bumpy though it may be, these decisions tend to be made. Barbara, I'm watching you and watching the time. Yes?
Could the International Criminal Court effort investigation indict President Assad for crimes against humanity, war crimes, and if found plausible, issue an arrest warrant like they did for the president of Sudan? I think only one, as far as I know, only one former head of state is actually been found guilty by an international court, and that was Charles Taylor.
That's right, the African case.
He was put on trial, probably would have been found guilty.
And then he died.
He had the good sense to die. but could the International Criminal Court, retaliate, on the basis of international law against President Assad?
The question is, could the International Criminal Court issue an arrest warrant for Assad? An appeal would have to come from several possible sources, or possibly the Security Council, a series of people who can present the evidence that there has been a violation of international law. So that would be an alternative. For a country that has not signed on to the ICC, they can say, I'm not in the game here. But even issuing an arrest warrant would be the beginning of something that might take place. I do think probably the U.S. is not likely to go the ICC way because we don't acknowledge it. But I do see the U.S. or other countries setting up something like the International Criminal Court for Yugoslavia or Rwanda, where you say that country has done things which seem so obviously in violation of the Security Council and war crimes and genocide that we insist there be a trial. And so it could happen. But I think the fact that it's worked twice and the ICC wasn't involved. The U.S. is stuck because we're not going to take part in the ICC. But we have signed on to the International Criminal Tribunals, and I think that's a way that it might be possible to have it happen. Other questions? Yes?
Isn't it simple-minded to think that Assad would, in fact, give all of his sarin, etc.? He just has to give some of it and say it's all.
You're asking a question, to what extent would we know that we had access to all these chemical weapons?
I'm answering it, actually. I'm saying
you're answering it. Yeah. Well, the whole issue with the whole, you know, chemical weapons thing is a matter of how secure can you be when a country says, we've given everything up. You can have the inspectors come in, you can say, we have these 10 spots, they go to the 10 spots to see all the chemical weapons have been destroyed. In no country can you say for absolutely sure, somewhere in a cave, they don't have something more. But at least it's in a direction that says, we will look at what is there. And chemical weapons, here we go. Well, I will step back and let President Obama have time. Thank you all.
All right,